The federal COVID emergency officially ended last month. And as part of the negotiations between House Republicans and President Joe Biden to raise the national debt limit, they agreed to force a return of $27 billion in funding to federal agencies that had been set aside for fighting the pandemic. According to reporting from NPR, this clawback included a significant amount from the Public Health and Social Services Emergency Fund for Emergency Preparedness and Response. Our next guest says we are in a predictable cycle of panic and neglect that leaves us unprepared for the next public health emergency. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How prepared do you feel the U.S. is for future public health emergencies? Do you see lessons learned or lessons ignored from COVID? What questions do you have for our guest epidemiologist about how the public health system works? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Caitlin Jedalina is the founder and author of the newsletter, Your Local Epidemiologist, and director of population health analytics at Meadows Mental Health Policy Institute. She recently wrote about this in that newsletter. Caitlin, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Now, first of all, this take back of funds at the end of the public health emergency, you describe it, there being chaos rippling throughout public health under the surface. What was the immediate impact of pulling this money back out of public health funding?
Yeah, we didn't really know what the immediate impact was until it started unfolding and the implementation was sent down the federal lines. And I think that this rippling effect is just not apparent to the average person because, of course, we're in a different phase of the pandemic, one that seems much more manageable with COVID-19. Why would we possibly need funding for an emergency? Well, this chaos is an incredible reality to us on the ground, and it's the clearest sign yet that the U.S. is really resorting to its roots in public health of, like you said, cycles of panic and neglect.
And that's the core of your piece. We get really interested in public health and argue about it when there's a public health crisis going on, and then out of sight, out of mind once it ends. Can you talk about how that pattern has come and gone and what it means for our preparedness?
Yeah, you know, this cycle of panic and neglect isn't new. In fact, it even has a name. The Sisyphean cycle was coined after Greek mythology about a trickster who received basically internal punishment for trying to cheat death and was condemned by the gods to roll a boulder up a steep hill for eternity. And every time he reached that top of the hill, the rock rolled back to the bottom, forcing him to start over again. And this hamster wheel effect is all too familiar in public health. COVID-19 wasn't the first boulder we've pushed up a hill. For example, in 2003, with the SARS epidemic, we pushed a SARS vaccine as quickly up a hill as possible. But then SARS was thankfully contained, research money dried up. No vaccine was made and the boulder fell down the hill again. I think what people need to recognize is if that boulder didn't fall down, we would have had a COVID-19 vaccine for the pandemic far quicker 17 years later than we did. I think there was a lot of hope among the public health atmosphere that a pandemic would change this model, right? Surely losing 1 million people could change something. But unfortunately, it doesn't look like that. And after giving our all, we're actively watching this boulder roll down the hill again.
When it comes to our public health infrastructure, you know, we've got federal public health agencies and state and lots of local, county, municipal, tribal, et cetera, et cetera. Did we learn any lessons about how to coordinate among all those levels better? Or is that another case of, you know, we started there, got there, and then let the boulder roll back down the hill?
Gosh, we learned a lot. We learned a lot about the need of coordination. You know, local health departments and state health departments do an amazing job on smaller outbreaks before the pandemic, but COVID-19 was just a completely different beast. And it showed our underfunded, fragmented public health infrastructure and really shed light on it. And like you said, the need for coordination. Right now, there's a massive move forward for data modernization so we can have data talk across state lines and to CDC more clearly. But even that coordination isn't being implemented on the ground. And a lot of people are fearful that we haven't or we're not implementing those lessons learned. And so I think that as professionals, we've certainly learned a lot. But again, implementation and what actually changes is unfortunately due to congressional funding and us figuring out a way to end this perpetual cycle of panic and neglect.
Now, you mentioned that previous SARS outbreak, and you point toward one country that you think did learn lessons, and that's Vietnam. Can you talk about how they handled that one, what they tried to learn from it that you say helped deal with COVID now?
Yeah, Vietnam's a really interesting story, and I've loved learning about them and watching them throughout the pandemic. You know, they have one of the lowest cumulative COVID deaths in the world. And this isn't because they just had a magic eight ball. You know, one reason is that they learned from their previous mistakes. They had an imperfect response to SARS. And instead of just going back to business as normal after SARS, they changed their entire system, public health system, through adequate funding, through implementation of a national public health response system, through core communications, through emergency capabilities. And it really paid off during the pandemic. And one thing I've been really hopeful for is us learning what worked and what didn't work and why during COVID, because this was really one of the first pandemic emergencies the United States has really had to face. And it would be a tragedy if we did not learn from those lessons.
We're talking to Caitlin Jedalina, founder and author of the newsletter, Your Local Epidemiologist. We're talking about the way the United States responds to, then moves on from, public health emergencies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You have questions for our guest. Do you think we've learned any lessons, or are we as unprepared as we might have been before COVID? Join in at 800-642-1234. If you work in public health out there, love to hear your perspective on this. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk about cycles of panic and neglect in public health. Our guest is Caitlin Jedalina, founder and author of the newsletter, Your Local Epidemiologist. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What lessons, if any, do you hope we learned from our public health response to COVID-19? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Joe is with us in Star Lake. Joe, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on. This is, might seem a very small thing, but I think it's a lot bigger than people realize. And when your guest was talking about core communication in a pandemic situation, this could be very important. We're a very visual society anymore. Most people are getting their information from television. And all through the pandemic, every time any news show covered the pandemic, even if it was a very positive thing about getting vaccinated, all they showed was images of people getting shots. My wife and I would just watch this over and over and over and think of Marsha McLuhan. It was totally the wrong message. It just made people anxious. And you never watch a drug company. We'll never do that. You know, they'll talk about their drug, but they won't see somebody getting shot with it. It was just the worst possible thing we could have done. And so we saw such an anti-vaccine attitude grow up. And I think this really played a role in it. And I think we should address that well in advance of the next time.
Interesting.
In fact.
Joe, yeah. Thanks for the call. Caitlin, the way we communicated messages to the public, we being the public health community, we in the media, the government, are there lessons you hope we learned as Joe hopes we do?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I completely agree with Joe, and I could sit here for hours talking about it. But quickly, I completely agree. We completely botched the scientific communication and knowledge translation throughout the pandemic. Both reactive, right? So combating mis and disinformation, but I think even more so proactive communication. We're not good at risk communication. We're not good at talking about uncertainty and taking people along for the scientific discovery ride. We didn't have massive health campaigns around vaccines. And so people, rightfully so, had a ton of questions and nowhere to really find evidence-based information to make decisions off of. And this is a huge problem, and we need to fix it so we get trusted, relevant, understood, and then used information out in a timely manner when people need to make decisions. And this is something I fear that we also haven't learned throughout the pandemic. And I've been disappointed in the little movement towards that.
Thanks a lot for that call, Joe, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Caitlin Jedalina. You can follow her work and read the piece we're talking about on the newsletter online called Your Local Epidemiologist. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Nancy is with us in Minocqua. Nancy, hi.
Yes, I'm kind of just upset and tired of our healthcare in this country and the pandemic and all that being a bipartisan. It's like each side has to do something to take something away from the other side. Democrats have to get it, then Republicans want to take it away, and it should just be something that we work together for to have health care in this country.
Nancy, thanks for that call. That's interesting, Caitlin, because when we look back at past pandemics, it seems kind of predictable that there's going to be some kind of political divide. And we read stuff about the 1917 flu outbreak and arguments over mask requirements, the first smallpox inoculations, not even vaccines yet in the 1700s, George Washington requiring troops to get inoculated. Is this something that epidemiologists like look at and try to figure out how to contend with, given that it seems to happen in most outbreaks?
It does happen in most outbreaks. In fact, public health is inherently political. We get our funding from Congress. We have to, outbreak and emergency decisions aren't just based on science, but it's also based on cultural and moral and psychological views of communities. And it requires bi-directional relationship with communities. And so I'm just as exhausted as Nancy about the bipartisanship and this fight against each other. I think one thing we could have done and should have done much better, and in fact, Vietnam did this, was we needed to set the stage of SARS-CoV-2 much earlier and really frame it as it's us against a common enemy, the virus, rather than us against each other.
Thanks a lot.
That messaging framing would have helped a little, but it's going to get political, and epidemiologists are not trained in that. And I think that we need to be, and particularly I'm very excited for the new director at the CDC, Mandy Cohen, because she gets politics and she gets operations. And I think it'll be very interesting to see what she can do with that.
Thanks for that call, Nancy. Daryl is with us now in Menominee Falls. Daryl, hi.
Yeah, I think that the health organization did everything they possibly could to make the public aware of what they thought would help with COVID. And we didn't have any experience with this in the past. This is all new to everybody. And also we had a president in office who did everything he could to fight against all the good advice that was put out there to get vaccinated, to get COVID shots and everything. And he laughed at it and made it, oh, it's not a big deal. It's just going to go away on its own. So we didn't even have a president that could lead and show the public the right direction to go to. And that really played a huge part against not being successful with having COVID handled properly.
Gotcha. Daryl, thanks a lot for that call. Caitlin, why don't we focus in on Daryl's first point there that, this is a disease that we hadn't encountered exactly before. It was something different. And that's in some ways always going to be the case in a pandemic. How we react to one disease might look different from another. Could you talk about that scramble to get a grip on a disease that may not look like the last pandemic?
It is a scramble. And I think that's a great way to explain it. And I think the best way to bring the public along is to communicate consistently about what we do know, but more importantly, what we don't know and how we're trying to find those answers. Because the information is going to change, and it was changing incredibly rapidly. And we weren't bringing people along for that scientific discovery ride, which made it really challenging for people to pivot when we found out new information and new ways to protect ourselves. And that's something we can do better in other crises, right? It's crisis communication 101. Be first, be right, be credible, and be empathetic. And I would argue that we failed on a lot of those fronts.
I want to take a minute or two to talk about where we are with COVID right now, Caitlin. The public health emergency is over, but it's not gone. COVID, as I'm reading, the seventh leading cause of death in the United States in this current year, 2023, over 1,000 deaths a week for the most part. What are you watching for in the current state of COVID, even though it's not, you know, as front and center as it was?
Yeah, we're in a really interesting time right now. In fact, in epidemiology, we don't even have a word for this like transition state between full-blown emergency and predictability. We're really in this transition phase. I think that, you know, all of us are really looking to see how the rest of the year plays out. Like you said, COVID is still around. It's mutating about twice as fast as flu. And I think the big question we have right now is, when is it going to become into more a predictable pattern? Is this the year that it falls into winter respiratory season with RSV and flu, or are we going to see multiple waves still? And no one really knows that answer. And unfortunately, we are at the mercy of time. We're also all holding our breath that we don't see a variant of concern come out of the blue. We actually have a pretty high probability of that happening, about 40% in the next year. And what that means and how hard it will be to have resources and inform people, given that we're not in an emergency mode with tons of federal funding, will be very interesting, to say the least, of how that unfolds. So there's still a lot of unanswered questions. I think a lot of us are enjoying this lull in massive transmission and really getting prepared for the fall and winter.
Caitlin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's Caitlin Jedalina, founder and author of the newsletter Your Local Epidemiologist. We talked to her about the ups and downs in attention to public health.